The following presentation was recorded live by Voices from Jerusalem.
Remember I mentioned, by the way, the initial relationship between Rome and the Jewish people goes back to Judah Maccabee, right? He makes an alliance with the Romans. We're talking about 2nd century. You know, and that alliance is going to be called in, as I mentioned in the last class, during the last two Maccabean sons who are going to be fighting over who's going to be king, Hyrcanus and Aristobulus, the sons of Alexander Yanai, and Shlomtzion Malka. Now, before we go further, let's back up a little and look at Rome, a little overview of what Rome is about, because it's very important not just to launch into Jews in Rome as if Rome just pops out of nowhere suddenly. Can you read it? No.
Sure.
Thanks. As it, Rome doesn't pop out of the woodwork suddenly. Rome, the area of Rome, by the way, much of it is colonized by Greece. We're talking about Greek Empire. There were Greek colonies, especially in the southern part of Italy. Rome dates the founding of the city of Rome, which is later going to become the Roman Empire. Rome starts out as a city-state, which expands. Is dated to 753 BCE. That's the Roman year, the Roman year one. So Roman calendar dates will begin at that date, which means the Romans didn't hold by the date 200 BCE, obviously. That was a non-event in their consciousness. That's only a Christian idea, which comes much later. According to tradition, and that date is probably, some of archaeology seems to testify to that date, Rome is initially, the area of Rome is occupied by different groups of people. One is called the Etruscan civilization, who were later going to be conquered by the Romans themselves. The Samnites. There's many different peoples running around. The origins of these peoples, we're not sure. Some historians and scholars claim they come from the ancient Near East, as are most people. Everyone at one point or another came out of, evolutionary-wise, out of Africa and through the ancient Near East, and somehow, either by crossing the Mediterranean or coming up through Asia and around over Turkey in that area, and is going to enter into Europe. Okay, that's not important. We're not doing anthropology here. But what's interesting is a little story about the founding of the city of Rome. I think when we get to Christianity, everyone will see the obvious parallel. According to Roman tradition, yes, sir? Exactly. That's what I'm about to get to. According to Roman tradition, first of all, Rome, a very old idea, during the Roman Empire and way before that, the Romans kept seven women called Vestal Virgins. Ever heard of Vestal Virgins? Who were women between, I believe, the ages of 12 and, I think, 35, who had to remain pure and chaste and virginal. And if any Vestal Virgin was found, and they believed that the chastity of this woman, the whole fate of the empire rested. Meaning they were sort of, pardon the expression, being Yotzi, everyone else. You know, like, Motzi, Wurch. Not that the Romans always behaved so morally, but the Vestal Virgin certainly had to. A Vestal Virgin found cheating was buried alive. Now, follow this story. I think everyone will see the obvious religious theological parallel later in history. According to the story, Romulus and Remus, who find the city of Rome, what's their background? They are the sort of illegitimate children of a Vestal Virgin by the name of Rhea Silvia, who is raped by the god Mars. So here you have a woman who has a physical relationship with a god. Ergo est, as we say in Latin, she remains a virgin, yet she gives birth. Sound familiar a little bit? Okay, the local king does not like the fact that a Vestal Virgin has given birth to a sort of quasi, godlike being, these two kids, Romulus and Remus. So they are basically abandoned. Okay, and they're raised by a she-wolf. Early Roman art depicts these two children suckling from a wolf. They will go on to found the city of Rome. One will go on to kill the other. I think it's Romulus kills Remus. Remus kills Romulus. I can't keep track of who kills whom. But according to Roman tradition, Rome is founded on the seven Palatine hills around the Tiber River. And it will eventually evolve into this great city-state. Okay? And as I said before, there are many different people. There are Greek colonies. There are Etruscans. There are Samnites, all living in the area. Rome is going to, above all of these different city-states, become the great power. Now, Rome evolves into a... Yeah? Right, but then the question is, Romulus and Remus, according to Jewish tradition, in fact, there are stories brought down in the Midrash about their connection. But yeah, that where Romulus and Remus from originally, where all these people's from, they're descendants of Edom, Esau. Esav has Edom, Edom. Can I prove that historically? I'm looking for connections to that. I have to look in Roman records to see if it's mentioned anywhere. As far as I know, I have not come across anything myself. But certainly Jewish tradition says just as the Arabs are descended from Ishmael. And they themselves accept that tradition. Although I don't think there's any direct evidence for that. So too, Jewish tradition teaches that Rome is descended from Edom, which is descended from Esav, and therefore there's this very interesting relationship going on there. Can I prove it or disprove it? No, you can't. Yeah, you can take it or leave it. Certainly from Jewish sources, we would say there's definitely something to it. There's no question in my mind there's definitely something to it. And if you look at what that relationship is based on, the Jewish-Roman relationship, it is so fundamental to the Jewish understanding of the worldview. And if you understand what Esav is all about, it makes so much sense that Rome and the Roman Empire are the spiritual inheritors of that worldview. It makes a lot of sense. As we go on, we'll explain a lot. There's a lot said by the rabbis about Rome, Esav, Edom. One of my little personal research projects is going to be to look into Roman records to see if they themselves have any such traditions recorded. I've seen things in Jewish sources, but until I see them from the Roman sources, I'm always very skeptical. But anyway, Rome will emerge initially as a republic. Okay, we're talking about around 500 or so BCE. This is all long after the founding of the city of Rome, meaning a republic ruled by a Senate. A Senate is an oligarchy where upper-class, land-owning male citizens will rule the country. The Senate had 600 to up to maybe 900 people at different periods of time. It's a very fairly sophisticated form of government. Rome will eventually evolve into an empire. We're talking about the last century of the Common Era. Now, the Romans will conquer the Greek colonies, and to a large extent, they will end up in the second century conquering Greece itself, and they will become the great power in the Mediterranean, and they will, to a large extent, be the people who will inherit this Greek view of the world. We call it Greco-Roman is the word used, because although Greece and Rome are two different peoples, different civilizations, different cultures, the Romans, to a very large extent, viewed themselves as the cultural inheritors of the Greeks, which is why that much of the Greek worldview, they will take the Greek gods and make them their gods. Ares and Mars, Jupiter and Zeus, same thing. Swap them, make them the same thing. Later on in Roman history, many of the Romans will view themselves literally in an almost a metaphysical way as the reincarnation of the Greeks. Roman architecture, much of the Roman worldview, in many, many respects, is certainly fueled by the Greeks. But the Romans are going to do their own modifications. They're different people. They have a different worldview. Rome is a much more conservative, patriarchal society than Greece was. They had initially, at least, very hard-working, kind of serious, kind of like that pre-Protestant work ethic view. There's many differences. One of the major differences is in the Romans' ability to organize in all spheres, something the Greeks were never good at, except under Alexander and his father Philip. Greeks, you know, were never organized, always fighting amongst each other. Rome are going to be the great masters of empire building in their ability to physically organize in engineering. Okay, the great engineers of the Western world are the Romans. You can see Roman aqueducts, Roman roads, Roman fortifications, Roman walls, they were incredible builders. Amazing knowledge of how to build. Incredible knowledge of how to build. Roman government and law. They institutionalized a system of law that would be used throughout the entire Mediterranean basin. Okay, very, very significant. Their ability to administer, to collect taxes. Okay, the greatest feat of Roman organization, however, is their ability to systematically conquer. We talked about the Greeks, and I'm into my favorite topic again, which is military history. It's worth mentioning a little bit about Rome and the innovations of Rome, because it gives us an appreciation of, A, who they were, and when it comes to the Jews revolting against Rome, it's going to give us a tremendous appreciation of the incredibly suicidal nature of those revolts. I mentioned in the last class, we're talking about the Greeks in warfare, that the Greeks really invented the concept of pitched battle, Greek phalanxes, heavily armed men with 70 pounds of armor, 21-foot-long spears. The Romans, now the Greek armies were essentially citizen armies. The Romans are going to revolutionize warfare in a way that's going to affect Western history unlike any people in history. The power, the mother of all modern armies is Rome. When I say mother in terms of a few things, professional army, not citizen soldiers. People who are paid and will fight in the case of Rome they'll spend 25 years as soldiers. Remember, it's not just the job, but it's a way of life for people, Roman soldiering. Okay? Standardization of equipment and training and tactics and you name it. Okay? It's all a Roman invention. Okay? They systematize warfare in a way that no other people was able to do, and because of that, they're given an edge in battle, which is basically unparalleled in human history. Nothing like Roman legions in battle. The Romans, first of all, they adapt, they take their Greek spear, they dump that long spear. They replace it with a thing called a pilum. which is a throwing spear, a javelin, with a metal end and a wooden end. It was very smart, the Romans. When you threw it at someone, it weighed a lot. First they would throw it at you, and they would charge at you. And if you tried to pull it out and use it against the Romans, it had a wooden pin and a metal pin, it would break in two, and you couldn't use it again. They're very smart people. They used a little Roman short sword. They replaced the heavy Greek armor with a smaller shield and chain-linked armor, or sort of scaled armor, which made the Roman soldiers much more maneuverable. Instead of these big, unwieldy phalanxes that could not move quickly, right? You got in the middle of a phalanx, you could slice everyone to bits. The Romans created what were called legions. This became the basic unit of the Roman army, like their brigades. The Romans would have between 26 and 28 legions. Legions were made up of cohorts. Okay, cohorts were made up of centuries. They had a century from 100. Each cohort had about 600 men. Therefore, you had about 10 of those in a legion. So a legion had between, the sizes would vary, 5 to 6,000 men, mostly infantry with a little cavalry. Okay, and these legions would operate independently. The Romans had tremendous flexibility on the battlefield, because they had smaller units that would fight, up to 100 men at a time, that could maneuver around in ways that the Greeks could never do. So the Romans just had, and again, they weren't big users of cavalry like the Greeks, because they couldn't support a lot of horses in Rome. In Italy, it was a very rocky place. But these are the masters of warfare. They learned how to fight in battle unlike anyone. They chewed the Greeks up incredibly. They slaughtered the Greeks. They slaughtered everyone, which is another great feature of Roman culture. On one hand, a very sophisticated people. On the other hand, probably the most, with the exception, the only exception I could think of who are more warlike and purely destructive than the Romans, are people like the Huns and the Mongols. You know, Attila the Hun, he's a guy like, people sitting on, piles of skulls, like a throne on a mound of skulls, that's a pretty, scary guy. And you get people who, like the Mongols, who just destroy for the sake of destroying. The Romans, at least, were into destroying and then conquering and building an empire. But they're remarkably brutal people. For centuries, with monotonous regularity, they would march out and wreak havoc on some poor people somewhere in the world. Okay, and the Romans viewed any form of resistance as the worst form of treason and rebellion, and they would crush in ways that it's hard to imagine how brutal the Roman legions were once they found themselves victorious. We're talking about complete destruction. Cities that were besieged by Rome, and they were the master siege makers of the ancient world. They would besiege. You read the Roman city of like when they're fighting against the Celts or the Goths. They would besiege their cities and build up huge fortifications the same height as the walls of the city, tunnel under the city. They had ballistas. They had siege equipment that could throw things the size of telephone poles up to half a mile. They had things that shot huge boulders. You'll go to the top of Masada today. You'll see these big, huge pile of boulders. Big. They weigh 400 pounds that they could launch over the walls of cities at you. Imagine being hit by one of those. Not too nice. Battering rams, towers. And Masada is a great thing to read. You read. Again, you want to read about this stuff? Read Flavius Josephus. Who has a copy of Josephus? Where is it? Show him the book. A must-buy. Here's a great version, by the way, to get hands on it. The Collected Works of Josephus. He gives very detailed descriptions, as many Roman historians of the time do, of Roman war, Roman siege techniques. These guys were a machine. A machine. These guys, when Roman legions marched into battle every night, they camped. They dug a moat every night and made a wall. They knew how to fight. Never caught very rarely caught the Romans, so to speak, with their proverbial pants down and ambushed them. Didn't happen a few times, but so we're talking about an incredibly aggressive people, a brutal people, a people with seeming unbridled ambition to conquer everything. We're talking about, remember Esav, a kol Yaakov, a yadayim yada Esav? Right, we're talking about the question of the connection. The spiritual power is Jews. Physical domination, that's going to be Esav, that's Rome. These were people who just conquered and conquered and conquered and conquered. Like the Roman motto was that t-shirt I once saw. Join the army, travel to exotic places, meet interesting people, and kill them. If they didn't surrender first. The Romans, by the way, were not just into just... If you surrendered to Rome, if Rome marched in and you basically put up little or no resistance and invited them in, Romans were very pragmatic people. That's the other great attribute of Rome. Aggressive and brutal, but very pragmatic. Pragmatic in the way they would rule, okay, in their efficiency, and pragmatic in realizing that to rule the greatest physical empire for the longest period of time, which is what Rome did more than anyone else, they had an empire that's going to last for 500 years, you could not rely on just brutal control of the local population. Romans often ruled through proxy. They used a huge amount of mercenaries. They would put puppet kings into place. And it was often very beneficial. Along with Roman domination, assuming it was a somewhat peaceful conquest, came a lot of benefits. Came the first great world culture. Right? You got the Romans would come in, and they would build you bridges and water systems and bathhouses, and they'd bring you that beautiful Greek-Roman culture. and everything that came with it, and all the intellectual tradition that came with it, and stability. Romans, very stable. They're soldiers, they built walls and places, you know, to keep the barbarians out. And then before you knew it, you had a nice little polis, like the Greek city-state. Yeah, the Romans built the same things. You had a nice little city with nice buildings and temples and public buildings and law and order. And definitely something to be said for it. You know, and compared to much of the world, it was for many parts of the world, it was a period of tremendous creativity, culturally, and stability, and whatever. So it wasn't all, very brutal people. These are the people who built, you know, over 200 locations in the Roman Empire, amphitheaters, which are the round buildings. You've seen World Perfect, I talk about it, where they would feed people to animals and watch people kill each other. These are people who went to blood and to domination. That was power. That was their whole thing, power, power, power. Okay, and the manifestations of Roman power are to be seen everywhere. That's the major reason why they had those sporting events. We're the bosses here. We are brutal. We don't mess around. We kill people for entertainment. Which is, again, a very interesting lesson in human history. We often will find the most sophisticated cultures being the most brutal. You see it with Rome. Most law and order society, most culturally advanced society, most technologically advanced society in the West, and the most brutal. Brutal, brutal, brutal society. Okay? So that's a little overview of Rome, a fascinating culture. You could study your whole life the Roman Empire. Go to Rome itself. Go to the modern city of Rome. Go to the Forum, which is ancient Rome. That was the height of Roman imperial power. And you get a sense. It's only a mere skeleton of what it was. You get a sense of the greatness that was Rome. Most of the most monumental structures throughout the Mediterranean, even in the land of Israel, are buildings that are built during the time of Roman occupation of Israel. When we get to Herod today, we'll talk about that. Okay? So that's just a little taste that we're talking about a major world civilization. We're talking about a little bit about the history. Now I gave a little background on the culture. Rome goes from about 130 to the 30 BCE, a period of time when the Senate is still in charge, but there's a lot of chaos. The Senate is weak. There are a lot of very strong generals running around. The central authority is shaken. Out of that will emerge one of the most significant people in the history of Rome, Julius Caesar. One of the great Roman generals. This is the period of time of the generals fighting for control, which is the classic. Rome was very often a military junta. Okay, different generals fighting for power. The support of your army would allow you to be emperor. Well, that's much later. Julius Caesar, who conquers much of what is Germany today from the nomadic peoples running around there, the Gauls, etc., he issued the most famous military dispatch certainly in human history. Anyone know what it is? Very good. Veni, vidi, vici. Actually, in Latin, it's veni, vidi, vici. I came, I saw, I conquered. That's Rome. I mean, there's, you know, again, travel to join the army, travel to exotic places, meet interesting people, and kill them. That's Rome. I came, we saw, we took him. It is our right. You want to see where imperialism comes from. This is a real Roman idea. Okay, it's our right to conquer. We are destined to be this great empire. Julius Caesar is going in 49. He's going to seize power in Rome. He's going to be assassinated in 44. Remember that great play by Shakespeare, A tu Brute, then fall Caesar? He's going to be murdered on the steps of the Senate by Brutus, which is going to lead to... He doesn't last too long. He's the first of what is going to be the series of great Roman leaders. His death is going to create a huge vacuum, which is going to lead to a big power struggle. You're going to have Mark Antony and a guy by the name of Octavian fighting against Brutus and Crassus. Okay, Brutus and Crassus are going to die. Mark Antony and Octavian are going to seize control. Mark Antony is then going to fight. He's going to have a girlfriend by the name of Cleopatra. Go see that movie with Elizabeth Taylor and Richard Burton. No accuracy there whatsoever, but nonetheless a great Hollywood epic. They're going to commit suicide after the Battle of Actium. Octavian defeats Mark Antony in this great romantic ending. Cleopatra and Mark Antony commit suicide. Octavian emerges in around the year 30, I think around the year 30, 27 BCE, somewhere right around there. He is going to emerge as the unchallenged leader of Rome. He will change his name to Augustus, certainly one of the greatest emperors in Rome, and this is the real beginning. From about the year 27, most historians say, Roman Empire, meaning ruled by Caesars with puppet Senate, Senate has no power really, is going to go from 27 BCE until 476, when the Visigoths are going to depose the last Roman emperor and the Western Roman Empire is going to cease to exist. So we're talking about a period of exactly like 500 years, 501 years, 502 years, something like that. Very long. Think about it, 500 years. A very long period of time. When you're going to have a series of emperors. Some of them are going to be amazing people, not from the Jewish perspective, from the perspective of world leaders. A guy like Augustus, one of the greatest leaders in human history. Some of them are going to be wacko, sicko people like, you know, Caligula. okay, who are going to be absolutely out of their minds, some, you know, and a lot of people in between there. And a lot of them aren't going to live too long. But this is the great period of time, what's called the Roman Empire, which is an empire which is going to expand and grow. As I said, with monotonous regularity, they're going to conquer and expand and conquer till by around the year 100 of the Common Era, Rome will control most of what is England, almost all of Western Europe, half of Germany, all the way through into the Balkans, you know, the area of Romania, Yugoslavia, all the way around through Turkey, all the way down through what was the to the Euphrates River. There's a Persian Empire which they never conquer. But all of what is Syria, Israel, Egypt, North Africa, Tunisia, Morocco, everything, the entire Mediterranean basin, an empire which by around the year one or so of the Christian calendar is going to have something like between 50 and 60 million people. Okay, huge. All of it under Roman law, with Roman roads, with Roman legions. The legions would be posted in specific hot spots. Places where, like on the Rhine, the Danube, where all those nomadic peoples who are later going to give the Romans so much problems, there'll be a lot of Roman soldiers there. Middle East, on the border with Persia, and when Israel gives them a hard time, a lot of Roman legions there also. But this is going to be the Roman Empire. Yes, sir? Well, Constantine builds Constantinople, but Theodosius, I think it is the second in the 4th century, he's going to officially split the empire into two. The 4th century, way, way later.
So when did the actual, you know, like the building the empire, when did it really start to decline?
No, well, you got to read Gibbon. The great book of this period of time is the British historian Gibbon, who wrote in the late 18th century, Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire declines for many centuries. Arguably, it reaches its peak during the reign of, like, Hadrian in the early 2nd century. But already by the mid-2nd century, you could say the Roman Empire is definitely on decline. It goes through periods of revitalization. You know, during later periods, during Byzantine periods, Justinian. You know, there's periods of stability during Diocletian's reign. There's a period of stability after a lot of contraction. But it's more like it's going down. It's like two steps backwards, one step forward, two steps backwards, one step forward, until late 5th century, it's gone. Okay.
Western,
not the Eastern. Eastern Empire was captured by the Turks in 1453. Okay, the Ottoman Turkish Empire is going to... Ottomans, yeah, 1453? Yeah, Ottomans are going to conquer Constantinople. Okay, now, that's a little overview. We're talking about Rome. Now, which means Pompey, by the way, is one of the generals who's involved in the time of Julius Caesar. He's one of the guys fighting for power. He loses out, he's gone. Okay? But we're talking about, that's our macrocosmic vision. We're looking microcosmically, we're talking about, is this period of time of instability when Julius Caesar emerges, is after the time when Pompey, who's only a general at the time, he hasn't seized power yet, he's not dead yet, this is the end of this period of time of chaos, when Rome is going through the transition from being run by a Senate to being run by emperors. Okay, so you have to see where the Jews are coming in here. And it's very important because to know larger Roman history makes much more sense of what's going to go on in the land of Israel with people like Herod. There's a lot of political machinations going on in the empire. Excuse me. A guy like Herod is going to be able to manipulate himself into a position of power based on what's going on in the larger picture, which is one of the great reasons why, if you want to understand Jewish history, you have to always have at least a skeleton overview of what's going on in the larger historical picture. Okay. So we say Pompey comes to Israel in the year 63. If you look on your little timelines here, we have Rome. 103 years. I don't know what that's referring to, actually, in this outline. I don't know what period of time. But and once the Romans come, they stay. Now, the Romans always conquer everything when they come. Okay, they didn't come and invited in by the Jews to mediate a problem, which is what's happening at this period of time. Right? Hyrcanus and Aristobulus are basically fighting a civil war over who's going to be the high priest and the ethnarch, who's going to be the sort of king of the country. They invite the Romans in. Pompey comes in. Again, if you read in Josephus, he explains all this in great detail. You'll do it on your own. The Romans slaughter lots of Jews, and they take Hyrcanus, who is the weaker of the two, and they make him the nominal puppet ruler of the country. This is the way the Romans would rule. If we can rule through proxy and allow the local governor or the local king or the local whatever to deal with the day-to-day problems of running the country, we'll give him support and we'll collect taxes and we'll make you part of our empire, then we don't have to station thousands of soldiers in your country, which is an expedient way for the Romans, who never could field more than the largest Roman army is probably 300,000 men, controlling all of Europe and all the Mediterranean and all of North Africa is not a lot of soldiers. So they needed to have, being the practical people they were, they needed local people to run the country. Herod's going to be the greatest example of a very effective Roman puppet ruler who in and of himself has a lot of power in his own area, sphere of influence. So Hyrcanus is going to be made the ruler. Now, I remember, I think I mentioned this, the Idumeans conquered forcibly during the reign of John Hyrcanus and Alexander Yanai. There are different peoples who are going to be forcibly converted to Judaism. I mentioned the Idumeans, who have a city, Meresha, Beit Guvrin. You can go there today, south of Beit Shemesh today. Very interesting place to walk around. The Idumeans, the Edomites, who had migrated into this part of into Israel from across the Jordan after the destruction of the First Temple. Many of them were forcibly converted. Hyrcanus' chief advisor is an Idumean convert named Antipater. Antipater is the true brains behind Hyrcanus. He's a really strong character. Antipater is eventually going to be murdered himself, probably by Hyrcanus. We don't know. I'm not sure. But Antipater, while he is around, he uses his position as advisor to Hyrcanus to get his sons into positions of power in the land of Israel. So once Aristobulus is gone and Hyrcanus is gone, Antipater is gone, who is left in power? His sons. The most important is a man by the name of Herod. Okay, Herod is one of the most important characters in Jewish history. Not as a positive character, but as a very, very significant person in terms of understanding Jewish history. Herod is going to live from 73 BCE till 4. He's going to be king of Israel from 37 BCE until 4 BCE. Very long reign of 33 years. And in many ways, a golden period of time, not necessarily spiritually, but in terms of prosperity for the land of Israel. Now Herod, very interesting. Herod is one of the great wily politicians of history. Herod, during all of this fighting in Rome, he's going to back Mark Antony with Cleopatra. And like Cleopatra and Herod always had at odds with each other. Cleopatra, by the way, owns a lot of land in Israel at the time. When after the Battle of Actium, Herod very quickly switches sides. Now Herod is the governor of the Galilee, the Galilee. He's ruling under Roman authority. How do the Romans rule? Romans would rule in a couple of ways. They would come in, appoint sometimes a puppet king, sometimes local governors. And the Roman Empire was divided into big precincts called dioceses. You know the Catholic Church today has dioceses? In a major area of the Roman Empire, they would put a guy by the name of a proconsul into place. A proconsul was a governor of a huge part of the Roman Empire. That was a person of tremendous stature, of senatorial stature, usually way up there. These guys would often become emperors. Proconsul ruled. There's a proconsul for the Roman Empire in Syria who's in charge of this whole area of the Middle East. If the Romans wanted more direct rulership under Rome, they would appoint a local governor of a province called a procurator. Okay, a proconsul is procurator. Proconsul is the big guy. Procurator is local guy. Israel sometimes had procurators, sometimes didn't. For most of the period of time of Roman occupation of Israel, there were procurators. We are familiar with several of these people. We got Felix Florus, most famous of all because of the New Testament, Pontius Pilate. These guys would rule generally for never longer than 2 years. Their major goal when they were here was generally to accrue as much wealth as possible at the expense of the local population so they could retire in wealth and pay off all their loyal soldier supporters. Okay, so most of these guys are sadistic and very cruel. If you read again in Flavius Josephus, he talks about these guys. They're really not nice people, to say the least. You know, Pontius Pilate, whom the New Testament is sort of painted as, you know, my hands are tied, I wash my hands, you Jews want Jesus dead, I'll kill him kind of thing. We haven't gotten to Christianity, I don't get the story. I mean, this guy was a bum. He was a vicious human being, all of these guys. Okay? Again, a major rule, by the way, I'll say it when we get to Christianity. Anyone who the New Testament says is good, Jewish perspective is bad, and vice versa. Guarantee it works in every single character in the New Testament story. The Good Samaritan, Samaritans are terrible. Pontius Pilate is a sadist. You know, these guys are all bad news. The Pharisees in the New Testament, these are the rabbis who saved the Jewish people. Now, in Israel, you're going to have a specific problem. Okay, we have to understand what is the root of the tension historically between the Jews and the Romans. To understand the conflict that's going to take place, we have to understand the history behind it. And keep in mind, very interesting fact of history, the Jews are going to rebel more against the Romans than any other people in the 500-year history of the Roman Empire. That's an incredible piece of information, by the way. Little teeny Jewish people, who, by the way, at this period of time were not so little and teeny, they're a very big ethnic minority, are going to rebel more than anyone else. And they're going to cause the Romans more manpower and more material losses than any other people, including the Gauls and all these other people and the Celts and everyone else who's giving the Romans all that source in Northern Europe. Okay? So we're dealing with the relationship between the Jews and the Romans is not only significant to Jewish history, but it's one of the most essential and problematic relationships in the history of the Roman Empire. The Jews and the Romans, bad news together. Okay, very, very bad news together. to understand the tension that's going on, we have to appreciate that the problem that the Romans have with the Jews and vice versa is more or less the same problem that the Greeks have with the Jews. Okay, which is a pagan versus Jewish problem, a fundamental difference in worldview. Romans being pagans. Pagans of the ancient world, very tolerant people, by the way, of other people's religions. Romans are not tolerant of people, but they're very tolerant of other religions, which is why they took all the Greek gods and merged them with their gods and why they adapted other gods. The Roman historian Varro writes that by the first century before the Common Era, the Romans had an excess of 30,000 gods. 30,000 gods. Why? Because everyone they conquered, they worshipped their gods. We'll take your 250 gods from your empire and we'll absorb them into our empire. Buy, like baseball cards, buy them, trade them, swap them. They had like albums, you know, get God pictures, you know. The Romans come in contact with the Jews, like the Greeks come in contact with the Jews. Okay? A people who believed in one invisible God. Okay? It's an idea that's going to be incomprehensible to the Romans. And the same tension in all those pagan, even after the Maccabees, there were plenty of pagans, colonists, Greeks, still hanging out in the land of Israel. And there were plenty of Hellenized Jews still running around. The Greeks did not, as I said, the Maccabees themselves, the later Hasmonean dynasty, became Hellenized themselves. So you can have an exact repeat. Here's a pattern that's going to repeat itself over and over again. The great cultural clash between paganism versus Judaism. Throw into that a very lethal addition, which is nationalism, which is much of the extreme right of the Jewish world at that period of time is going to be outraged by the fact that pagan, uncircumcised Romans are going to be dominating the Holy Land and worshiping idols instead of the one true God. It's a very bad combination. And in addition to all of that, you're going to have the constant tension between the Jews themselves. You're going to have a tremendous amount. The Second Temple period, the great theme of this period of time is not the dangers of foreign domination, but it's going to be the sinat chinam, the hatred of one Jew for another Jew. It's going to be the real fatal, the straw that breaks the camel's back for the Jewish people. The hatred of the assimilated Jews for the religious Jews and the tzedukim in the middle and and it's so complicated. You need like a huge flow chart to figure out all the different little factions and schisms and political parties. You know what it looks remarkably like? Israel today. It's unbelievable. If you want to study the pitfalls and the dangers of the modern state of Israel today, all you got to do is look at the history of the Jews in the Roman Empire. It's one of the great paradigms. And we are still living. You've got to remember, all the stuff, when you look through all this information, we're still living in the diaspora caused by the destruction of the Second Temple. Even though we are back in Israel, 40% of the Jewish world, we are still in diaspora. The majority of the Jews don't live here. The temple isn't rebuilt. And therefore, the same problems that caused that diaspora are the same, back 2,000 years ago, are the same problems that are still very much in the Jewish world today. When I mention the idea of sinat chinam, causeless hatred, I don't think anyone has to be a big, you know, political science or scholar of modern state of Israel to realize that by far the biggest problem in the land of Israel today is just the hatred that Jews have for each other. Ashkenazim, Sephardim, secular, religious, and how we deal with the Gentiles amongst us, and everyone, you know, and who everyone thinks they're right. It's a very important lesson. You study this period, you have to study this period really carefully. And where does it all go back to? You've got to study the relationship between Jacob and Esau and all that. It all has its roots back in early Jewish history. So the rabbis, before they would go to Rome to plead for the Jewish people, would always study the story of Jacob going to be reunited with his brother Esau to learn what to do. We too, when we want to look at the modern state of Israel, we pay a lot of attention to the history of this period of time. Because if we don't read the writing on the wall, so to speak, we're going to suffer very bad consequences, disastrous consequences. Okay, enough philosophizing. Let's go back and look at a little more of the history now. So Herod, okay, Antipater's son, Herod, governor of the Galilee, and a cruel, vicious guy he is, believe me. The Jews in the Galilee do not want Herod as king. He has no right to be there, in their opinion. He's not king yet, by the way, at this period of time. They certainly don't want him. The Galilee is always a hotbed of Jewish nationalism and extremism in Jewish history at this period of time. As a matter of fact, if you go to the Sea of Galilee today, there's a huge cliff above the Sea of Galilee called the Arabel. Now, Masada, by the way, the great Masada story we will talk about in the next class, may or may not have happened, by the way it's described. We know it was besieged and it was destroyed by the Romans, the suicide story and all that stuff. We're not sure it happened. We only have Josephus to account of that. But we do know that in the Arabel, which is this huge cliff above the Sea of Galilee, Jews who did not accept Herod, but Herod had the backing of Roman soldiers because he was a Roman puppet, the governor, were hiding out in the caves. There's a lot of caves up there. It's amazing cliffs. Herod, basically, the Jews were going to fight to the death up there. They went in these caves. They were inaccessible, like Masada is sort of inaccessible. Herod, the Roman soldiers would lower themselves down in baskets. Again, read Josephus, he describes, it's very interesting. They would fire flaming arrows into the caves. The Jews would, rather than surrender to Herod, would just jump out of the caves and commit suicide. We're going to see this idea of martyrdom becomes a huge thing at this period of time. Okay, we already see at the beginning of this initial interaction of Jews and Romans, you could see it's bad news. Jews are not going to accept lightly Roman domination of the land of Israel, even though Rome is so overwhelmingly, you think the Greeks were strong in the Mahanika story? Rome made Greece look like nothing. Rome was a much bigger world power. To rebel against Rome would be equivalent today of Israel declaring war. I would say the only thing I could think of would be NATO and the Warsaw Pact combined. That's how strong Rome is. Okay? So we're dealing with already, we see the initial interaction between Jews and Romans, it's very bad news. A small percentage of the Hellenized Jews, and of course the obvious pagan non-Jews in the land of Israel, are going to support the Romans. But the vast majority of the Jews want nothing to do with the Romans and are going to follow the rabbis. Okay? And this tension is not only in the land of Israel, it's going to be in the whole Roman Empire. Just to step out for a little bit, let's look at the Jews in the Roman Empire before we go forward in history. Jews in the Roman Empire are a very significant percentage of the population. Today we look at Jews. Jews are 0.25% of the world's population. During the whole Second Temple period, very interesting piece of information to keep in mind, the last period of time when the majority of Jews lived in the land of Israel is the First Temple period. There is no period of time during the Second Temple when probably the majority of Jews are living in the land of Israel, which means probably within 10 to 15 years, God willing, we will have for the first time the majority of the Jews of the world in Israel. It will be the first time in 2,500 years that the majority of the Jews will live in the land of Israel. During the entire Second Temple period, there is a huge Jewish diaspora. My personal estimate, which is not my own statistics, but based on what I've read, is I estimate that at maximum, a third of the Jewish population of the world is living in Israel during the Roman occupation of Israel, which means there are two-thirds living outside. How many Jews are we talking about? No one knows for sure, but people like Michael Grant, who's one of the greatest, great classical historians. He has dozens of books in print. He has a great book, by the way, if you ever want to read a really interesting book on this topic. It's called The Jews in the Roman Empire by Michael Grant, G-R-A-N-T. He says that in around 2,000 years ago, there were 7 to 8 million Jews, 6 to 7 million Jews living in the Roman Empire. Roman Empire meaning the entire Mediterranean basin. Okay, everything. Meaning that we're talking about 7 million Jews. Out of 50 to 53 million to 55 million maximum people, what percentage of the Roman Empire is Jewish? It's like 12%, at least 12% of the Roman Empire. That's huge. The Eastern Roman Empire, where were the Jews concentrated? And you had Jews, by the way, living in Spain and in parts of southern France and in the Rhineland. During the Roman Empire, during the early part of the Roman Empire, Jews lived in most places in Europe and the Middle East before the people who lived there today lived there. It's a very interesting piece of trivia, by the way. We've been there before almost anyone else, certainly in the Middle East. The majority of Jews didn't live in Europe. The majority of Jews lived in, because the ancient Near East was the center of world culture and close to Israel, the majority of Jews lived in Alexandria in Egypt. Alexander the Great built 6 Alexandrias, of which the one we know that survives today is still Alexandria in Egypt. That was the most cultured city in the ancient world, much more than Rome, much more than Athens. A third of the population of Alexandria is estimated to be Jewish. Huge city, like 750,000 people, of whom at least 250,000 were Jews. Largest synagogue in the world was there. I mentioned they built Heliopolis outside Alexandria. Honya, the high priest who was deposed, remember, during he built this model temple there, and he practiced as high priest outside Alexandria. Synagogue that was so huge, right, when you got an aliyah to read the Torah, you had to wave a flag because you couldn't hear the guy saying Borchu because there's so many thousands of people sitting there. Huge number of Jews living in Cyprus. Could be the majority of the population of Cyprus was Jewish. You had Jews living in Italy. Huge number of Jews living in Syria, Antioch, all the way out in the area where Turkey is, all around there, and of course, another probably million or more Jews living in the Persian Empire outside of Rome, never conquered. 8 million Jews living in the Roman Empire could have been. In the ancient world, 2,000 years ago, of whom 7 million could have been living in the Roman Empire. That's huge, which means the West, the Eastern Empire, 20% Jewish, which means Jews in Rome were like Chinese vis-a-vis the world population today, 20% of the population. We're talking about a huge ethnic minority, which is very important to understand how the Romans are going to treat the Jews, and it's also very important to understand how the Jews are going to affect the Roman Empire, especially when we get to Christianity in like two classes. We're going to see that the ability of Christianity to spread is to a very large extent going to depend on large numbers of Jews living amongst and influencing their pagan neighbors, often in positive ways, not only negative. There's a lot of tension, but there's a lot of positive interaction also. So we have lots of Jews. In general, the Roman attitude towards the Jews throughout the empire was one of tolerance, meaning Jews were granted exemptions from Roman state religion. Now, it's very important to remember, if you want to be a student of history, that religion and state go together in all empires in the ancient world, more so in Rome than almost anywhere. You had emperor worship, deification of emperors as gods. Why was it so important that what do you think? Why was it so important that state and religion be linked together so strongly? Because it gives, and I mean, there's an interesting idea. We'll see this throughout human history. It gives legitimacy, obviously, to the ruler, to have the backing of the priesthood, so to speak. But it also gives, since you have people like Pharaoh in ancient Egypt, with a classic case of a physical ruler who is a god, who is the god, who is the most important character, and all of the Egyptian efforts were spent on this guy's afterlife being good, so the whole empire would rise or fall depending on how Pharaoh would interact with the gods after his death. The connection between temporal power and spiritual power gives the government complete control of your physical existence and your spiritual existence. Complete control. I got you in this world, I got you in the world to come. You're going to see the Catholic Church is going to do this in medieval Europe. A great physical power, a great spiritual power. You don't like what I say, we excommunicate you. Tremendous power, absolute power is what it gives the ruling authority. So therefore, state religious function in the Roman Empire is a vital part of Roman identity and loyalty to the state. Romans, being the pragmatists they were, despite the fact that they could not understand the Jews and their monotheism and their invisible God, were smart enough to realize that in the Eastern Empire, where 20% of the population is Jewish, we got to grant these people an exemption because they knew, they already saw from the Greeks, that the Jews will not be forced to worship idols. They're not like other pagan peoples. They're not going to conform. So the Romans are granted Jews an official status of being exempt from Roman state religion. On one hand, it's a very smart and very tolerant policy. Of course, the Jews had to pay a special tax, Fiscus Judaicus, which is in place throughout the entire Roman Empire. This is you want to be exempt, so you pay us a tax. At periods of time, the tax is going to become very heavy and also punitive. Okay, so the Romans are definitely pragmatists in this respect. So there is an idea of Jews, you follow Roman law, okay, you pay your taxes, we'll leave you alone, we will live and let live. Now, if not for the deeper spiritual battle between paganism and Judaism that's going to characterize this period, and if not for the nationalistic stuff that's going to come into the picture in the first century, who knows, you may have gone along peacefully with the Romans for centuries, but unfortunately, it's not going to last. It's going to explode into a huge conflict. That conflict is going to start long before the actual events of the Great Revolt in the year 70. And I'm going to stop now with that, and we're going to pick up next week. I want to talk about Herod the